Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's cool fact of the day is a group of crickets is called an orchestra. In 1992, a guy named Jim Wilson took recordings from an orchestra of crickets and slowed it down to the equivalent of a human lifespan. The cool thing is, he figured out it sounds like an orchestra choir.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us, and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's guest is pretty exciting. It's Chris Kresser. Chris runs ChrisKresser.com, and he's the author of this amazing new book called Your Personal Paleo Code. If you're watching on YouTube, you can check it out right now. Chris is a licensed acupuncturist and a practitioner of integrative and functional medicine. It's a very well-respected website, and I've talked with Chris on the show, I'm guessing about 18 months ago in one of our earlier episodes. I'm definitely a fan of his work. He was named one of the 50 most influential people in health and fitness by Greatest, along with Dr. Oz and Michelle Obama. Although I hear Michelle Obama has better arms than you, Chris. Is this true?
Could be. I don't know. She's got some guns.
Definitely. Now, Chris, you got a mysterious tropical illness in your early 20s, right?
Yeah.
This led to you becoming essentially a guy who's hacked his own health and then started helping others. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little more about what happened there and kind of your experience when you returned and said, there's something weird going on with me. I don't know what it is.
Sure.
What happened?
Yeah. So I was in my early 20s. I worked for a little while after college, and then I sold everything I owned and took off to see the world. Ended up spending about a year and a half traveling around the world. And when I was in Indonesia, I was doing some surfing. A whole bunch of us that were in the water got sick, and it was a classic, you know, vomiting, diarrhea, fever, delirium. I don't really remember anything for that 3-day period. And I fairly quickly recovered my health. You know, it was like the acute episode. I got better. But then as the months progressed, it became clear that that it wasn't getting better, and in fact was getting worse. And that led to like a decade long period of where I was just really sick. I didn't know what was going on. I was seeing every kind of doctor or healthcare practitioner you can imagine. I flew to three different countries to see top specialists in infectious disease, tropical disease, gastroenterologists. I flew all the way to Sydney to a gastroenterology clinic there that's world renowned. So, and then I was seeing, you know, doctors of Chinese medicine, naturopaths, Ayurvedic specialists, energy healers, shamans. I mean, you name it, I was basically doing it. And I did probably 13 to 14 special diets, from macrobiotic vegan to raw foods to like a traditional Chinese medicine type of diet with almost everything cooked. To, every supplement that you can imagine, herbs, conventional medications, you name it, I did it. And it just became clear at some point that the person that was most invested in my healing was me.
Yeah.
And if anyone was going to figure out, it would be me. And of course I was, you know, I think everyone that I saw, all the conventional doctors, they meant well, and their heart was in the right place, but they just didn't have the tools to help me. So I decided to go back and study integrative and functional medicine for two reasons. One, because I wanted to gain the knowledge and the understanding of how to look at the research studies myself and critique them and know what they're saying. Because as you know, Dave, they often say something different than what the media reports them as saying. And then I also, in the back of my mind, was thinking, man, I hope this experience is worth something, you know, to me and to other people, because I've been through the ringer here, and I know that what I've gained from it is valuable, and I know that I can help other people. And so that's essentially what happened. I eventually, kind of found my way through the labyrinth and made it out to the other side. And then I finished my degree and opened my doors. And now I really kind of specialize in helping people who are dealing with fairly complex conditions like the one that I struggle with for so many years.
It's amazing how desperation is the best medicine, you could say.
That's very accurate.
I had a similar experience in that when I weighed 300 pounds, I had chronic things, you know, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, Lyme disease, the whole thing, and saw hundreds of people and ended up going down a similar path. I never formally studied medicine, but work with a lot of the same tool sets around, especially nutritionally. And it's just because I didn't want to feel like crap all the time, just like you didn't. And that burning need to not die in your 20s.
Yeah, that's a powerful motivator for sure. Not wanting to wake up doubled over in pain every day, or feel like you have not enough energy to, you know, get through even half the days when you're in your early 20s, it's a pretty powerful motivator for sure.
Because of the work I do with the Silicon Valley Health Institute, an anti-aging nonprofit group where a lot of our members are older, and I see the same kind of motivation with people when they get sick in later in life. But the few people I know who got really sick in their 20s and really got focused on hacking it tend to have the sort of zeal that most people get for these things much later in life, but it gives you a lot more decades to accumulate knowledge and really to help other people with this kind of knowledge. Because I don't think anyone in medical school, including my wife, you know, Karolinska graduate, just, you can't get that from school. You get it from waking up in the morning going, how am I going to live today? So how did that come down to this, the personal paleo code? Like what's the transition from there into your new book?
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest things I learned in my health journey was that, as I said before, that I really had to figure it out. And that doesn't mean that help wasn't all around me and that I didn't reach out for help and advice from other experts and colleagues and friends. But it did mean that I ultimately was the authority on what worked for me. And, you know, I could read a book and learn about someone else's experience. And that was often helpful in that it gave me things to try and experiment with in my own, biohacking process. But at the end of the day, no matter how beautiful a theory was, or no matter how transformative an approach was for somebody else, if it didn't help me, then, you know, it wasn't really that useful. So and then of course I started to work with patients and I saw the same things. I saw, you know, I could give people a set of basic guidelines and they could start there and those were a good starting place, but then they would have to customize and tweak it under my guidance to make it really truly sustainable and adaptable over the long term. So I developed this three-step approach in my clinic working with patients to help people create their own ideal diet and lifestyle plan that's based on the paleo approach. It's not strict paleo, as you know, but it's based on the paleo approach. And I've found that to be extremely useful. And the feedback I got on that process was great. And I decided that it was something worth sharing on a bigger scale. And a book is just a vehicle for doing that, really.
It definitely is. And I think you did a great job in the book of of helping people understand that personalization. When people write into your blog, and certainly I'd probably get the same thing, they say things like, you know, just tell me what works. And, right. And the answer is, well, don't you have a mirror? Right?
Like, I mean, my job would be a lot easier if I could just say, this is what works. I mean, I would just have a web page and there would be what works, and then that would be it.
So do you recommend other biohacking tools for people? I mean, certainly you use labs in your practice, but do you have people or do you recommend that people do certain self-tracking to know what works? Or is it all just more like, you know, do I feel good today? Do I not feel good? Like how rigorous or quantified is your approach to helping people see that they're not doing something that's wrong?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I would say there's even some personalization there too, because I think different people will have different some people are really drawn to a quantified approach and really get into all the tools, and other people will be less drawn to that. So I don't really necessarily advocate hard for a particular approach, but I like to offer people tools, and then if they are drawn to using them, then great. So one thing, for example, that I use with blood sugar is a glucometer. Yeah. So I'm sure many of your listeners know what that is, but for those that don't, it's a device that you can use to test your blood sugar at home. And that can give you a really more objective way of determining what your carbohydrate tolerance is. So that's one example. A pedometer like Fitbit or something like it, I often recommend as a means of tracking non-exercise physical activity, which I think is arguably more important than exercise.
You know, if we were in the same room and not on other sides of a video here, I'd high five you for that one. Non-exercise movement, right? It's such a huge thing. I just that bears repeating for people listening here. Movement matters, but it ain't exercise. So, all right, keep going. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you deserve extra credit for that.
You probably know it's one of my passions too. And just a little side note here: when I started to write the book, I realized I was going to kill myself if I did it the way I had started, which was sitting in my chair just typing away. Yep. And so I got a treadmill. That's when I got my treadmill desk, and I ended up. In the course of writing the book, I walked 2,200 miles while writing. And so that was a huge lifesaver for me. So anyways, back to quantified self, the Fitbit pedometers, certainly scale for people who are tracking their weight. Like you can do Whitting scale or more sophisticated scales. I like online tracking tools like Dan's Plan. Which offer the ability to track your sleep and your non-exercise and exercise physical activity, as well as some other markers. Sometimes if people are inclined to track what they're eating, things like Fitbit.com or nutrition data or what's the other one? There are a few out there. And then I have one of my own tracking tools that I use for my patients, and that I originally just used it with my patients, and now it's part of some online programs I have where they fill out a questionnaire with subjective symptom responses, and then so they can then see their progress over a period of time charted out on a graph. Okay. So there are some others too, depending on specific issues, but those are the basic ones.
That's a great list. So you do include that for people. Mm-hmm. I found that when I started getting sick, this was almost 20 years ago, I didn't have any level of trust in how I felt. Like, I ate my Wheaties, therefore I should feel lots of energy. Therefore, I do feel lots of energy.
Yeah.
How long does it take someone who comes in and sees you in your practice to realize that they have some degree of visibility into how well or unwell they are on a minute-by-minute or day-by-day basis?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think it really differs from person to person and depends on the level of body awareness they had before they, you know, before they come to see me. If typically athletes, dancers, people who've been involved in physical activity tend to have a higher level of that because they're just a little bit more tuned into their bodies. Meditators are also like that, or yogis, people who are doing that kind of stuff. But yeah, I've had, you know, a typical kind of, your typical stereotypical male who, you know, works in an office perhaps, and isn't talking a lot of touchy feely subjects, or, you know, isn't really tuned into their body. I do have them track. I usually have people do a symptom journal, symptom tracking journal, where they'll track their diet for a period of time, and then they'll write down how they feel at various points throughout the day as a way of just facilitating that kind of awareness. And generally within a month, if they're doing that fairly regularly, they start to make connections like, oh, I had that bagel, you know, when I knew I shouldn't have, and then I had heartburn that night.
Bagel,
you know,
equals kryptonite.
Right. And maybe not even they were missing that before because it wasn't immediate, you know.
Yeah.
But then they were able to see, like, on Tuesday and Saturday, and then they had something in the morning they shouldn't have had, and that night they had heartburn.
I found that when I started this, I was exactly that guy. I weighed 300 pounds. I had, you know, high performance Silicon Valley career and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Sitting under fluorescent lights in a cubicle all day long.
Yeah.
And I started taking notes in the margin of my work notebook, you know, the laboratory books all the engineers carry. And I'd say, eat this, feel like crap. And what I found out, though, was a lot of my symptoms were a two-day lag time. So I would, like, cheat on Friday. You know, this idea of cheating once a week isn't particularly new. It's been around forever. So I would try this, and I would be like, wow, my Mondays and Tuesdays are a wreck because of what I did on Friday night. And it wasn't alcohol. It was just like, ooh, I had bread.
Right.
So in your book, though, you talk about how you follow the program about 80% of the time. But, I mean, aren't some things just off the list versus 80% of the time? Like, how do you teach people, like, really, don't eat that crap?
Yeah. So the 80-20 rule is really more of a concept than the actual percentage. And in most cases, it's more like 95-5.
Okay, I buy that.
for most of my patients, or 90-10. Some people that are just extremely robust and healthy can get away with 80-20 perhaps. But I also talk about in the book how it depends on your health status, your goals, and what the specific thing that we're talking about. Yeah. So if you're celiac or you have gluten intolerance, non-celiac gluten sensitivity, then you have 100-0, you know, rule with gluten. Means 100% of the time you avoid it. And there's no, that doesn't fall into the 80-20 rule at all. Likewise, if you're you're healing from some kind of chronic illness, or you're maybe trying to optimize your performance, or you're trying to lose weight, or you have some kind of goal that you're trying to reach, then it's probably going to be more like 95-5 as well, because you're not in an optimal place, and so you don't have as much flexibility and leeway. So that's meant to be kind of a scalable percentage depending on your health status and your goals.
What a wonderful answer. And in my own experience, like, you learn this cheat is an expensive cheat, and this is this is not an expensive cheat. I'll have the cheap cheats versus whacking yourself over the head just because it was going to taste good.
And you know, Dave, some people, I'm not a zealot with the 80-20 rule either. It's like, some people like a strict paleo approach. It doesn't bother them at all. They're happy to do that. And they don't need the 80-20 rule. It's just it can come in handy at times for certain people. That's about it.
That makes sense. And if you're the kind of person who's going to die if you don't have a glass of wine, and wine doesn't knock you out for a week, then hey, you know, more power to you. All right, I hear you.
Yeah, and I'm jealous.
Me too. I would love to drink red wine, but seems like kryptonite to me.
Doesn't work for me either.
So, all right, let's talk about genetics then. You talk about body type, your genetic blueprint, and individual needs, but can you basically fix your genetics? And like, what's a body type?
Yeah, so I think the whole genetic question is fascinating because it's evolving so quickly. I mean, even just 10 or 15 years ago, the epigenetics was a fairly new concept, and we didn't really have much of an understanding of how important gene expression is in this whole dialogue. And so we were largely just talking about genes and single nucleotide polymorphisms and their effect on health. And, you know, when you looked at the effect of SNPs on health, you would see like less than 3% of disease is exclusively related to single nucleotide polymorphisms. You know, just to, like if you have this mutation, you're absolutely going to have this disease. But now we know that it's way more complex and great and nuanced than that. You can have a genetic predisposition, and then an environmental trigger activates an epigenetic expression, and then that combines with several other factors that we're only beginning to understand to create this your own particular milieu of health and disease. And so I would say that my view on the contribution of genes to disease has kind of evolved over the past few years. Maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said it was less of a contributor than I think it is now. Just as we start to examine and learn more about these, especially epigenetic expressions. Yeah. And so maybe my answer is I don't fully know how to quantify the contribution of genes, but I do know that environment. I still believe that environment trumps all of that. Yeah. And the reason that I believe that is because although there have been some genetic changes recently, our genes are largely the same as they've been for a long time. And a lot of the modern diseases that we're suffering from are very new on the evolutionary timescale.
Well said. For instance, I'm 4% Neanderthal. I know you can see it in my overhanging forehead. Do you have your 23andMe results?
I do have them.
Do you use them?
I don't. I've used them for more like methylation and detox stuff, but I haven't gone into a lot of detail with the other data, frankly, just because I haven't had time in the last 6 to 9 months to pay much attention to them.
When I started talking about this stuff about 5 years ago at the Silicon Valley Health Institute, even before I started writing for the Bulletproof executive blog, I was pretty down on these because I've seen the studies that show you send the same samples to two different labs, you get two different answers. But I've also, I think like you, I've shifted my thinking. You have a lot of epigenetics knowledge from your Healthy Baby Code. I wrote the Better Baby book, which is an epigenetics book that's out there. I don't know if you've seen a copy of it or not, but we both share that perspective. But I've found lately when someone goes on a paleo-like diet, they go on the Bulletproof diet or any sort of health regimen, if they don't see massive reductions in inflammation, I'm like, just get your 23andMe results and run it through Genetic Genie, and you can look at your detox profiles. And every single time, it's like a methylation or transsulfation pathway issue. Are you seeing the same thing with people? It seems like almost 90% of the time.
Yeah, I see methylation issues are like one of the biggest impediments for people when they're not having the responses that they. And not only to weight loss stuff, but like if I'm treating a patient for gut issues and I'm using the same similar protocol that I use with all my other patients, but they're just not getting better, and I do retests and their markers are the same, and we do the same sort of the 23andMe and Genetic Genie or any of the other services, and almost certainly they'll have some kind of methylation issue or transsulfuration. But I see more methylation in my patients.
I've seen more of it from the people who chose to share the results with me. And sometimes it's just, hey, I'm going to point you there. You go do your own homework, but it's going to come up. So I got to say hats off to Amy Yasko for bringing all this out to everyone. I don't know if she listens to either of our podcasts, but I've gotten an awful lot. And if you're listening to this and we're getting a little geeky here, Chris, there's usually like 50,000 people the first week. We just hit like top ranked on iTunes.
Cool. So, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, man. What we're talking about here is what happens, the way your body breaks down toxins, and different people do it differently based on their genes. That can really affect what vitamins you should take, whether folic acid is going to knock you out or not, things like that. And if you are already performing at a super high level, having this knowledge is still good because then you can avoid things that are just not going to work well for your genes. But if you're not performing as well as you want, then knowing this isn't terribly expensive these days. Unless, of course, the FDA's attack on 23andMe sort of ruins things, but...
Yeah, there is that, yeah.
All right, what about body type? How does that play a role into what foods you should eat?
So, to me, I mean, the way that I do this process is not so much about, okay, if you have this body type, eat this way. If you have that body type, eat that way. I generally start, the first step of the process, as you know, is a 30-day reset, what I call, it's similar to a 30-day challenge, and it's the strict paleo approach. And that's, I basically think of the paleo diet at this point as an elimination diet.
It pretty much is.
Yeah, so you do that for 30 days, and then there are some ways that you tweak it depending on your body. So if you're overweight and you have blood sugar dysregulation and you want to lose weight, I would steer people towards a lower carb version, even during the first 30 days, and slightly higher protein intake for the same reason. And, if someone has autoimmune condition, a known autoimmune condition, I would steer them towards an autoimmune version of that as well, the first 30 days. And then the second part of the process is reintroducing gray area foods that are, I think, healthy when well tolerated, like full fat fermented dairy, raw, if you can get it, et cetera. And then stage three is where the body type issues would come more into play. And that's where we talk about macronutrient ratios. We talk about meal frequency and timing, three meals a day plus snacks or intermittent fasting, carbohydrate backloading, customizing your diet for activity levels and goals. If you're 60 pounds overweight and trying to lose weight, you're going to have a different approach than if you're, training for the CrossFit Olympics, for example. So I don't actually focus quite as much on body type as just personalizing all of those factors for each individual.
That makes sense. So we were talking about body type, and you're not paying as much attention to it as you are to the person themselves. So it's not you're shaped like a pear, you're shaped like an apple, you're shaped like a carrot or whatever else. That matches my experience as well. Now, how do you respond to the argument that we're not cavemen anymore, we don't live like them, it's not cold when we sleep, we don't live in caves, we don't see saber-toothed tigers, so why should we actually bother to eat that way?
Well, I think it's a valid question, first of all. I mean, I actually find myself agreeing with a certain aspects of a lot of the most recent paleo critiques, like Marlene Zook's paleo fantasy. The problem is I think the critiques often are a little bit oversimplified and they throw the baby out with the bathwater. So one example would be the idea that there was no paleo diet because everybody... there was such a huge variation in what our paleo ancestors ate. So the concept of a paleo diet is silly because there was no one diet. Well, okay, that's true. There was a tremendous variation in what people ate, but what we also know absolutely what they weren't eating.
Yeah.
They weren't eating cheese doodles and drinking big gulps and, having industrial seed, eating like all kinds of processed and fried foods and cooked in industrial seed oils. We know that without a doubt. So I think, it is important to tell people when you're talking about a paleo approach there is a lot of variation in what humans can tolerate within the template of a basic paleo diet. But it doesn't invalidate the entire concept just because there was a lot of variation in what people ate. Likewise, you'll often hear the idea that our ancestors died when they were 30. So why would we want to emulate their diet and lifestyle? That's just crazy. And it is true that average lifespan is 30 years old, but that doesn't take into account the challenges that our ancestors faced that we're not facing today, like very high rates of infant mortality, trauma, violence, exposure to the elements, et cetera. And if you take like a hypothetical group of 10 people and three of them die in infant, you know, in childbirth or infancy, another three or four die during their teenage or childhood or teenage years, maybe one gets eaten by a lion, a few others die in some kind of tribal warfare or exposure to the elements, and three live until they're 80, the average lifespan of that group of 10 people is going to be really low, you know, 25 years old or something. But that doesn't really paint the whole picture. So I think the best way to think of the paleo concept or is as a starting place, as that we know that we're well adapted to that lifestyle and to that diet. And we can use that as a jumping off point to create our own ideal diet and lifestyle. But this is not about recreation, as others have said before me. You know, we're not, it doesn't mean you have to sleep outside in the backyard and run around in a loincloth.
That's too bad because I just got a new loincloth, but I'm going to.
And I mean, it's sleeping in the backyard. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's not required.
Exactly. So what about intermittent fasting? You mentioned that earlier. What's your take on intermittent fasting?
I think it's beneficial for certain people in certain situations. And you probably hear me saying this sort of thing a lot, but it is what I believe. So I think it can be helpful for weight loss, for blood sugar regulation and insulin sensitivity, for infections, chronic infections. I think it's not that helpful in some cases with people with adrenal fatigue, people with hypothyroid issues, depending. Women who are pregnant, I wouldn't necessarily recommend a lot of intermittent fasting.
Amen.
Kids, I don't recommend intermittent fasting very much because they're growing. They need all the nutrients that they can
get. My kids don't fast.
I think a useful tool to have in your bag. And just personally, I find myself moving in and out of it. Some days I'll intermittent fast just kind of spontaneously because it feels like the right thing to do. And other days I'll eat more normal, you know, three meals and snacks. So I really, at this point, just try to tune into what my body needs and go with that.
There's not a lot of research on what daily or intermittent fasting is going to do for long periods of time. And I did that for quite a while, although I do bulletproof intermittent fasting where you just have the bulletproof coffee with pure fat, but I didn't want to activate my protein or sugar pathways. I found that after a couple, good 3 or 4 years of doing that, like six days a week, that I still do it most of the time, but I think it's beneficial to not do it every day. So at least 2 days a week, I kind of forced myself to have breakfast, even though I don't like breakfast anymore because I have more energy when I don't have it. And I'm playing around with what that might do to some of the various like sex hormone levels, because there's no, I don't think we're really going to see any scientific broad scale studies of intermittent fasting in enough populations with enough variations to really tell us a lot.
Not unless you pay for those.
Yeah, but I mean, to do it for 4 years later, you're going to feel this. I don't think there's. I'm not that kind of a wealthy guy. I always say I made $6 million when I was 26. I lost it when I was 28. Like the company went bankrupt. All right, I experienced a burst of wealth that let me get well, but I didn't stay with it. So.
Right.
Yeah, we'll have to crowdfund that one, Chris.
Yeah, I think so. No, I agree. I mean, I think if there's one thing that is constant, was constant for our ancestors, it was change.
Oh, yeah.
And so you know, the idea that they were intermittent fasting every single day is not accurate either. I mean, we can say for sure that they went periods where they didn't have food or access to as much food, but they weren't doing things in as routine of a way as we were on any side of the equation. So I think that introducing some variability and maybe even some random variability is a really good idea.
All right. Here's a crazy question for you. What about water fasting? And I don't mean having only water. I mean, some days like not drinking very much water and then some days drinking more than normal and varying the intake versus 8, 8 times a day. I've been playing around with that lately.
Yeah. I definitely have some experience with that at one point during my, the sort of deepest, darkest periods of my illness where I just couldn't digest anything. I would just go for days without eating, and it was more out of necessity than anything else. But I think if someone is relatively robust from a health perspective and has a relatively strong, is in a fairly good place, that fasting like that can be beneficial. But again, it's kind of like intermittent fasting. I wouldn't recommend it for someone who's really weak, for someone who's got really significant adrenal fatigue. This probably goes without saying, but I always like to be clear, pregnancy is not a good time to do that. So I think there's probably a place for that, but I would say it's more for people who are fairly robust.
When my wife was 16, she did a water fast for a good number of days. She didn't have an eating disorder or anything. She just read about it in a book on Eastern meditation. So I'll try this. And she broke her thyroid and couldn't gain weight for almost 20 years after she did that. We're going to put even more fat into you. She finally got the curves that she lost at that time. So I think there are some risks to it, but I also know a lot of people benefit greatly from like a 4-day water fast.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's as you pointed out, there are some non-physiological benefits too, some psychological and spiritual benefits. Some of the more extended fasting periods have been when I've been doing like meditation retreat. And it's really interesting to see, for me, some of the most interesting insights that I've had from fasting have been related to my relationship with food. Yeah. And how I use food for other purposes than nourishment. And I think just for that reason alone, it's probably worth everybody doing some limited period of fasting.
Yes.
Yeah.
My longest fast was 4 days, and I did it in a cave with no one around me for 10 miles in any direction in the desert outside Sedona. This was led by a shaman. So the idea was, I just drop me off in the middle of the desert by that cave and like hang out there. I'll be back in 4 days. And I wanted to expressly look at, okay, what is no social contact and all the emotional stuff that comes up with that and no food, just water. Like, what's that going to do? Yeah. And it was for me about working on the relationship between food and other people. And it was a really good experience, to be perfectly honest, but most people don't have time and space to make the connections there that you're talking about. Right. So you've experienced that in your own life. Do you ever recommend that for people you work with?
Not typically. Okay. But sometimes, it would be a kind of special patient and a special set of circumstances that I would. I do tend to recommend it in situations where I feel like people have, where there's a strong need to examine that relationship and to kind of, there's like a pattern that can, fasting can really help break those patterns in some situations that are just unconscious and repetitive, and taking a step out of that with a fast can really help somebody to gain perspective that they can't get otherwise.
Well said. We touched earlier on exercise versus movement. Now, what about on the exercise side of things? What kind of exercise, for how long, how frequently? Like, where do you come down on that?
Yeah. I tend to be a little more conservative on that front probably than some others. I think certainly there's plenty of room for really high intensity training and people who are training for a specific reason, purpose, athletics, etc. I'm not a big fan of, doing like 5 Metcons a week in CrossFit, for example. I think CrossFit can be done in a way that's really healthy and beneficial. And then there are a lot of CrossFit owners and trainers out there. I have a lot as patients. I have a lot on my email list and I talk to a lot of them. And I think there are a lot of people doing really sophisticated, smart training in the CrossFit world. But there is also, you know, a group within the CrossFit world that I think is essentially just driving people into the ground. And yeah. I mean, I would say, like, if I could start like a CrossFit recovery group in my patient population. Yeah. I mean, I would say like some fairly substantial percentage of my patients are people who've been pretty wrecked from CrossFit. Their adrenals are completely tanked. Their sex hormones are just on the floor. They can, in some cases, hardly function. And it's really challenging, to tell you the truth, to bring them back. It takes a long time. And they're also tend to be the type A people who, like, as soon as they start to feel even a little bit better, they're going to go right back to what they were doing before. So it's the challenge is really inviting them to see that type of physical activity is really only meant to be done for short periods of time, if at all, and can't really be sustained over a long period without doing damage, especially in the context of the modern life. I mean, maybe if that's all you were doing and you didn't have a full-time job and you weren't sleep deprived and everything else, it might be possible, but not the way most people are living now.
I do most of my coaching when there isn't a lot of time every week for coaching with what I do, but it's typically very successful entrepreneurs, CEOs, hedge fund manager types. So these guys are as type A gets. And then I've definitely seen a handful of them, same thing. You know, I started doing CrossFit and like I lost my mojo and I'm, you know, sleeping all the time. And it comes down to the life of being an executive or a high performance business person like that. It's like running a marathon that never ends.
Right.
Just the lifestyle.
Right.
You're on airplanes, you're doing this. And certainly I've lived enough of that. And for me, having coming out of this, you know, I'm pretty darn sick. I'm 100 pounds overweight and I'm living that lifestyle. To be able to bring all that together and to be able to learn how to live the lifestyle and stay even or even improve my health doing it, I had to look at my exercise load and I reduced it. And if I get a lot of sleep, I'm, you know, okay, fine, I'm going to work out more. But that notion that I'm a fan of CrossFit because of the high intensity and the heavy lifting and things like that. It's a stimulating exercise the way exercise should be. But I wish it came with a label that said, must sleep 2 hours extra the day you do this workout. And if people would do that, I think CrossFit would work really well. And I don't sleep 2 hours extra almost any night. I'm too busy. I think you are too. You're launching your book here on New Year's. Yeah. So just for people who are listening and doing CrossFit, right level of intensity, just do recover from that intensity, please.
and eat enough too. Yeah. I mean, I actually, like a lot of people don't understand the connection between activity level and calorie intake. And I mean, it seems pretty basic, but a lot of my patients are coming in, I have them fill out a full food diary. So I know exactly what they're eating. And then I look at their exercise routine and I'm like, and I just do some numbers and they're like underfed by, you know, up to 1,000 calories a day in some cases.
What do you think about the food companies like charging more for 100 calorie bars?
Right. Yeah.
Can we do math?
Yeah, I mean, it's so I think you're right. CrossFit should come with a label, but I do think there are a lot of smarter people now. I mean, I think the awareness is increasing a lot. I mean, I know that because I talk to a lot of CrossFit gym owners and trainers, and they're definitely, and they're often the people who are suffering from these problems. So they're aware of the situation and they're doing, you know, I think they're doing their best to change it. But as you pointed out, a lot of people who are drawn to CrossFit are the type of people who are likely to engage in that kind of activity in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's not, the blame is to be shared.
It is to be shared. And part of it belongs with restaurants. You go to a restaurant now and you order a dinner and you spend $30 and they give you like 2 ounces of protein, 4 like stabs of asparagus and a little dollop of some kind of other thing. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but I need
and a basket of bread.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, hold the bread. I need 4 of those. And here's my stick of butter that I'm going to be put that I brought with me so I can get enough calories because I'm a big guy. You know, I'm pretty muscular and I cannot sustain the level of cognitive performance I need to do the work that I do and to be with my kids if I eat at restaurants unless I order 3 meals. And then it's like $200 a day to feed myself.
Right. Yeah, it is. I guess that's where the bread comes in, yeah. Right? They expect that you're going to fill yourself up on that before you eat the dinner, and then you're going to have a big piece of cake afterwards.
Yeah.
And then you're going to drink 3 or 4 beers as well, which helps to fill you
maybe
up.
Maybe add a little bit of MSG at the beginning to drop your blood sugar so you're guaranteed to buy the cake. You know, people like that.
Exactly.
All right, one more thing. Have you seen Christiana Warner's TED Talk totally debunking the paleo diet?
I've seen parts of it, but, you know, to be honest, I've just sort of lost interest in those things at this point.
Amen.
I understand it. I do. And, you know, paleo is kind of ripe for debunking because of the way it got set up early and because it's so easy to make a caricature of it and use the whole caveman Flintstone thing and people, you know, carrying around big hunks of meat. And so it's easy to understand on one level. And yet on another level, it's kind of ridiculous because you can support, and I do this in the book, the paleo diet using all modern clinical research and not relying on the evolutionary argument whatsoever. Everything that in the book, there's over 800 references from studies in the book. And, you know, from when you look at nutrient density, the you know, eating organ meats and fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds is what we should be doing. When you look at it from the context of an anti-inflammatory diet, this is what we should be doing. When you look at, you know, the importance of physical activity and all of the lifestyle stuff we talk about, that's all well supported by modern research. All of the arguments against foods on the paleo diet, like red meat and saturated fat, have fallen apart under further scrutiny, as you well know. So I just don't think they're, anyone says they're debunking the paleo diet, I'm like, okay, so you're debunking decades of modern research that shows us that eating nutrient dense whole foods is bad for me. I don't think so. So I'm not going to waste my time. That's basically where I'm at with
it. I kind of look at debunking the paleo diet as trolling for traffic for your blog at this point.
Yeah.
Because anyone who's tried it for a month, I don't know anyone who tried it for a month and didn't go, wow, I feel better. I lost weight and my brain worked better. They might have gone back to eating pizza and donuts. But that's an emotional or some other kind of motivational issue. It's not that the diet didn't work. And it doesn't take 2 years to work. Like some of these low-calorie diets, you lose a half a pound a month, and eventually you'll come to equal whatever. Like that didn't work on my 300 pounds. I'd still be dieting if I did that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean the one part of it which we already talked about before that I can appreciate, and of course you know this from my book, is that just because of food wasn't eaten during the Paleolithic, that in my mind doesn't mean we shouldn't eat it now.
Agreed.
And yeah, so I think that did need to be debunked as a concept because it was pretty prevalent out there for a while, this idea that if we didn't eat it during the Paleolithic, we can't eat it now. And so I'm glad that that has evolved, that kind of awareness. But other than that, it's just a nutrient-dense whole foods diet and that focuses on the foods that are have the lowest level of anti-nutrients and the highest level of micronutrients, and the foods that we've been eating for the longest period of time and that we're biologically and physiologically adapted to eat. I think that's as simple as that.
Yeah, I'm really pleased that you've taken that step of extending the paleo diet and the Bulletproof diet, similar thing. I didn't start out from paleo. It started out from epigenetics and the Better Baby book and all that like a long time ago. But the idea that you have to be pedantic about, I don't eat things with faces, I don't eat things our cavemen didn't eat. Like, look at the bounty of evidence for whatever's in front of you, whether it's, you know, sea algae extract or, you know, some, you know, tree sap that no one used to eat, or even a processed food. You look at biochemically, what does it do? Epidemiologically, what does it do? And then you make a judgment. And if you're not doing that, you're not thinking, you're just following rote rules that are probably going to break down as things change. So kudos to you for helping to push paleo beyond the, you know, I didn't grow it in my backyard, I'm not going to eat it kind of thing, because I don't think that served people, and it makes paleo too exclusive for it to become mainstream, which is cool.
Yeah, and that was exactly my intention with this book, was that if I could explain paleo in a way that wasn't that exclusive and didn't demand that you sign on to this whole paradigm, you know, you just look at it as a nutrient-dense, healthy way to eat rather than a club that you join, then I thought it would be more appealing to a broader number of people.
Yeah. I think you're onto something there. Chris, we're running towards the end of the show, and there's a question that I did ask you a long time ago when you were on the show, but it's one I ask every guest, so I'll ask you again. What are your top three recommendations for people, not just paleo or anything else, but top three from your entire life experience that you would recommend for people who want to perform better? So if you wanted to kick more ass, what should you do?
Wow, great question. I don't remember how I answered. I'm sure it'll be different.
Good.
I'll have to go back and check it out. I guess I'll answer just what's been on my mind lately. Lately, I've been thinking that sleep deprivation is the number one health challenge that we're facing today. So I would say sleep. It would be number one if you want to kick butt, because if you're not sleeping, you're not kicking butt almost certainly. Number two would be do some kind of regular stress management practice or meditation practice. Meditation is one of several options. I'm a big believer in this. And I think, again, that I think it's so crucial that in a lot of cases, my patients are on a perfect diet, but they're not managing their stress or doing anything that increases their self-awareness, and they're still really struggling. Whereas I have patients who, you know, maybe are a little more lax about the diet, but they're able to focus their mind and they have a certain level of self-awareness that really helps them to accomplish their goals, whatever their goals are. And I think it's hard to do that if you don't have self-awareness. And then number three would be, don't follow somebody else's diet, follow your own diet, and do the work that's required to figure out what that is, even though it does take longer than just following a cookie cutter approach. And you will not be sorry, because you'll have that for the rest of your life. And not even that your diet will be the same the rest of your life. What you'll have is the ability to continually fine tune and tweak your diet based on your needs in each moment. And that's what it's all about.
Chris, thanks a ton for that answer and for being on the show. Will you tell our listeners where they can get a copy of your book when it launches at, I think, New Year's Eve?
Yeah, it's December 31st. So it's personalpaleocode.com. And, of course, it's available at all the usual locations. It's also Kindle and Fire and iBooks and audiobook if you prefer to consume it that way. And my main website is chriskresser.com. Dave, I want to thank you again for having me back. It's always a pleasure. I enjoy our conversations and look forward to seeing you at the next conference, whenever that might be.
You got it, Chris. I'm sure we'll see each other at AHS or Paleo FX or somewhere.
Great.
Everyone, thanks for listening to the show today. And Chris, thanks one more time. We will check in with you all next week. If you enjoyed the show, please like us on iTunes, check us out on Facebook, or even better yet, try Bulletproof Coffee. You'll like it. Thanks.
You will.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.